In June of 1924, an extraordinary Englishman named George Mallory made his third attempt to ascend to the summit of Mount Everest. It is the tallest peak to climb on the planet. In 1924, few had come anywhere near its peak, except George, actually. 2 years earlier, in 1922, he got close, probably within about 2,000 feet, when an avalanche took out seven of the Sherpas, the servants that had assisted him, and he had to go back home. And he was already world famous. He had toured Europe and even America, talking about almost ascending to the top. But now, in June, 2 years later, at the age of 37, I'll call that the prime of life, I'm 38, and accompanied by an Australian fella named Andrew Irving, I think he was about 22, they did it. They worked their way up the side from camp to camp, and at each camp you would leave some team behind, the team that assisted you in getting to that point. And it was a rigorous and difficult journey, and they left a group of men at base camp 5, and they moved up to base camp 6, about 800 feet from the top, and they were seen ascending through that last cloud bank to reach the top, and they became the men who first stood literally on top of the world. Talk about your true mountaintop experience. He'd worked his entire life to get there. And the truth is, his future was set for good. He would be famous, instantly tenured back home, funded in any project that he pleased. He had written a letter to his wife back when he was down in base camp 4 or 5, and he handed it to a friend, and it said, "Baby, when I get home, you and me and our 3 girls, we're going to stay home, and I'm not going to do anything but stay home with you guys for the rest of my life as soon as I get this one feat accomplished." He's had a future set with comfort. All he had to do was make it back home. You've never heard of George Mallory because George Mallory never made it home. He reached the great goal of his life, but somewhere between the peak and getting back down to base camps, to base camp 5, he or his traveling companion, Andrew Irving, stepped off a pathway somewhere. They were tethered together. They fell to their deaths. George's body was found 75 years later. In 1999, if my math is right, he always kept a little picture of his family in his pocket that he said he would place upon the top of the mountain when he reached it. And there was no photo in his pocket. I'm convinced that he got there, but he was famous for saying, even before that, during the youth of his life, that the climb down is always the hardest. And he never made it back down. I want you to think about George's story a bit with me as we go through this study. It was an amazing achievement. I mean, Mount Everest, 29,000 feet. That's where all the airplanes are flying out there. It's massive. But it occurs to me, and I hope to you tonight, that the mountaintop experience only really matters if you make it back home. Can you understand that with me tonight? The reason I bring that up has actually little to do with that story, though it is the motivation behind what we'll be studying. Around the same time I was reading that book, there's a book called Paths of Glory by a fellow named Jeffrey Archer, and it tells the story of him. And I was really enamored by that story and saddened by its conclusion. And by the way, nobody did that until the 1950s. You guys know Mr. Hillary, right? He gets all the credit for that. That was 30 years later. But around the same time I was listening to this audiobook, I was also reading in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, and I want to parallel some of what we see in this story with the Israelite story of 1 Corinthians chapter 10. They too had their mountaintop experience. They were on top of the world. Everything they'd ever longed for, yearned for, and wanted, they stood up on the rock and they received the blessings of it. I'm not talking about the ascending of Mount Everest by two men. I'm talking about a nation crossing the Red Sea, finally achieving their entire life goal and standing on the rock on the other side. And I really apologize for the poor picture. The internet is an amazing place, but there were still no photographs of the Red Sea crossing. Can you believe that? On the internet. But this represents a people who were in a place, and I can see George and Andrew up on that mountain just singing and thanking God and just drinking in the experience. Well, that's what they did. When they crossed that river, that sea, and they came through on the other side, and they stood there, and they saw their freedom behind them, they sang in Exodus 15. They were on top of the spiritual world, and in fact, the rock upon which they stood was nothing less than Jesus. And that story is told to us in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Let's take a look. 1 Corinthians 10 verse 1. For I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea and all ate the same spiritual food and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they were drinking from the spiritual rock which followed them, and the rock was Christ. They achieved freedom and prosperity. And look, not unlike our climbers, from the moment they came out the other side, their future was set. Didn't mean it wouldn't be difficult, not unlike climbing down a mountainside. Didn't mean they wouldn't have to march a ways or overcome some adversaries, but God was going to be with them. Their future was secure. They would have all the food that they needed. They would have all of the water that they needed, and they would possess great land. They had it all set out for them. Nevertheless, verse 5, nevertheless, with most of them, God was not well pleased, for they were laid low in the wilderness. The mountaintop experience only truly matters if you make it home. The text says that somewhere between the jubilation of this moment and the security of the land of Canaan, most of them fell. You already know that 601,548 soldiers died in 38 years. They buried 40 guys a day for 38 years. After this celebration, because somewhere between the moment of victory and the home that it preserved, they stepped off the pathway. And many of them were tethered together, the Israelites. And when one stepped off, others followed, and they didn't make it home. Tonight, we are actually not here to talk about either one of those groups. We're here to talk about you and me. How many of you have been buried in the waters of baptism and had your sins washed away? And have been raised up. He talks about a baptism in verse 1 and 2, but he's referencing ultimately your baptism, and have been raised up to stand upon the spiritual rock that is Christ, to stand upon Mount Zion in the glory of the Lord, to be fed with the nourishment of God. Most of the people in the room here have enjoyed that mountaintop, top of the world spiritual experience. Do you remember yours? I was young, but I remember every second of that moment. That day, that event, when we did that. Look, this chapter is saying something happened with these people, and they went from there astray, and they never made it home. And his point, verse 6, is these things happened as examples for us, so that we would not crave evil things as they also crave, so that somewhere between the mountaintop experience and heaven, we don't crave something and lose it. He says it again in verse 11. These things happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the age have come. George Mallory's lesson just sort of lets me think about all the work that goes in, and you got to be careful to get back home. But the Israelites is God's example to you to make sure that you do better and your baptism doesn't go to naught. I've seen it too much. I don't know Pensacola, Florida. I'm just getting to know most of the people in the room. But I know that you know people who came up out of that water with the biggest smile on their faces you've ever seen. You were hugging them even though they were soaking wet, and you didn't care. And we sang songs, and we held hands, and we prayed together, and we talked about how this is what life is all about. And I know a lot of people that I did that with who are not going to heaven. Little step to the left, little tethered move connected to someone else to the right. And all I can tell you tonight, and you're going to hear me say it a handful of times tonight, and you'll just have to get used to that over the next 20 minutes, I can't speak for you. I can't speak for even my own kids. All I can do tonight is speak for me, and here's what I've got to tell you tonight. I'm going home. I mean, literally, I'm getting on an airplane tomorrow. I'm going home, folks. Y'all, we have established that y'all is fine in the panhandle of Florida. I did not come up out of that water to die along the road. I did not reach that experience of closeness with God just to run away and lose its ultimate destination of heaven. So here's what we're going to do. Short lesson. I know, always known, that the secret to having any chance of being invited back to a gospel meeting is you got to keep it short on the last night. But your elders already invited me back. And it's already written down, so that's out the window. But honestly, I think we'll get through in just short order. I need to show you a few things, and I want you to think about them. And let me just say something about that. Let me take a minute. I'm going to show you four things from this text, and we'll be done tonight. If you're in 1 Corinthians 10, you're exactly where you need to be. And if you're not in 1 Corinthians 10, you're not yet exactly where you need to be. Open your Bibles. But let me tell you a little bit. So I'm really thankful to get to come to this town. Had not been here before, maybe traveled through, had not met most of the Christians here. I have been filled up with good conversation, with good banana pudding, with all kinds of stories and relationship building, and I'm thankful to you for letting me come. Most of you didn't know me before this, and you've been extremely kind. I'm thankful to the two shepherds here, to Mr. Hardy and Mr. Larry. They put together these weeks for your benefit. They let Hal pick some of the preachers. He puts himself on the line. You know, that's nice, that whole deal about, I remember Hal, he picked good preachers, but guess what happens if he picks bad ones? I remember Hal. Hal. I don't know the difference between a good or a bad preacher. If we're preaching the truth, we're doing the best we can. But I'm here to do what I can do. And I'm thankful that you allowed for that. And I'm thankful to spend time with Hal and his family. They're great. You know that his three girls are just wonderful. Tracy's a great wife, mother, servant. She knows all about this. Her dad was a preacher. She knows all the ins and outs. She said, I would never, ever, ever marry a preacher. And that was a mistake when you said that. You made a mistake. Because that's what makes that come about. But she loves it. She loves what it means to be connected to you. With kids, you love Taylor, you love Kylie. They love it here. And so I just am happy to see one of my Texas brothers excelling and doing well and enjoying such a good family here in Florida, and you enjoying him. 4 years, not very long. It is not very long. And if everything goes according to plan, I'll be back here in about exactly 4 years from today. And the reason I say all that is this. When I get back here, let's all still be headed towards heaven, folks. Let's not have one soul in this room, not one person who has enjoyed the spiritual blessings of Jesus, somehow wandered off thinking, oh, I'll wander right back and lose their soul somewhere. Let's not see any soul abandon its great hope, the hope of the excellent Sabbath rest of heaven. Let's stay moving forward. I'm going home. And I hope you are as well. If we're going to do that, we need a few warnings. We've kind of taken a positive outlook to our lessons this week, like celebrating the presence of angels around you and the power of God to save you. But tonight is some warnings. And those warnings are found for us in verse 7, 8, 9, and 10. So I'm going to give you four indicators of how someone might step off the pathway and lose their way home. And the first one is found in verse 7. Do not, I will stay on the pathway in the face of these four things. Do not be idolaters, as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink, and they stood up to play. Now again, came through the water, mountaintop experience, died before they got home. Why? Because some of them fell victim to idolatry. Now, depending on the Bible that you have with you tonight, the publisher and the version, etc., you should have some notation there in verse 7 that says, hey, this is a quote from the Old Testament. Because this passage, the people sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play, is a quote from Exodus chapter 32. So here's what I need you to do tonight. Mark 1 Corinthians 10, if you'd like. We'll keep coming back there. But go ahead and turn back with me, and let's get a little better idea in Exodus 32 of what in the world happened that cost people their access to their spiritual and wonderful home. The passage says in Exodus 32 and verse 1, "Now when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people assembled about Aaron and said to him, 'Come, make us a God who will go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him.'" You remember the story now? They're at Mount Sinai. I mean, they're at the great mountain of God. And their spokesman, Moses, is up there getting the law. But he's taking too long. They're growing very impatient with whatever God's doing here, whatever kind of plan he's put that has us just sitting down here for 4 or 5 weeks. We don't like that plan. So Aaron, we need you to do something. Give us another way to worship. So in verse 4, the Bible says, "He took this from their hand, all the gold rings and etc., and fashioned it with a graving tool and made it into a molten calf. And they said, 'This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt.' Now when Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made a proclamation and said, 'Tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord.'" God was very, very displeased with this decision. God expected them to trust him, trust his messenger, trust his timing, and trust his way. They did not do that. So in verse 9, "The Lord said to Moses, 'I have seen this people, and behold, they are an obstinate people. Now then, let me alone, that my anger may burn against them, and I may destroy them, and I will make of you a great nation.'" Now things have changed dramatically. Because a very short time before, they came through the Red Sea, and God held them up, and they sang songs of great praise to him. But now their idolatry has changed the game. And Moses pleads for God to keep the nation around. And so in verse 28, "The sons of Levi did as Moses instructed, and about 3,000 men of the people fell that day." Folks, 3,000 people didn't go home. They never saw the true reward because of idolatry. Now let me tell you, and I told Hal on the way here that I had something to suggest in this first point, that at least please everyone stay awake through the first point because I have something to share. That maybe is a little bit different than what you've heard, but I've tried to figure out, what is this idolatry about? Do you think that the people were saying, "We don't believe in God anymore. We want to replace Yahweh. We're just going to forget that there even is a Yahweh, and we're going to build a piece of metal, and that's our Yahweh"? I do not think that's the idolatry of this text. I mean, the mountains got smoke and fire and quaking and sounds, and I mean, Yahweh is definitely there. I don't think they're saying, "We want to replace our God." I honestly think what they really want to replace is Moses. I think they're saying, "We don't like the way God is doing this." And so this idea is, in verse 4, "This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up." And in verse 5, Aaron said, "Okay, we'll build an altar before it. We'll build an altar before the calf, and tomorrow shall be a feast to whom?" To Yahweh. Ah. "We will continue to worship God. We just found a better way to do it. We don't have to wait. We don't have to listen. We can do it our way." Folks, let me tell you about modern day religious idolatry in America. It is very rarely, "We don't want to believe in God anymore. We're going to create a different God." I don't see that very often in East Texas. You know what I see in East Texas? "We still believe in Yahweh. We're just going to make our way to worship him. We're going to come up with a plan, or we don't have to wait, and we don't have to be as disciplined, and we don't have to stay as traditional, and we can sort of expound upon the desires that we'll take the gold out of our ears, and we'll just build something." And every time I drive by a denominational or a New Age church and I look at the parking lot, very frequently at least, I look at it and I see their great building and I see their beautiful parking lot freshly paved. And usually what I see in my mind's eye is a golden calf right there in front of the front door. I'm going home. Are you? That means we have to continue to worship God God's way. What does the Bible say? Book, chapter, and verse. I try not to use like old language, you know, but sometimes the old language is awesome. Book, chapter, and verse. What does the Bible say? False religion is dangerous, and they became subject to it very, very quickly. And God said, replacing my plan is tantamount to replacing me, and that's idolatry. So if you want to get to heaven and I want to get to heaven, we became Christians by doing it God's way. Would you agree with that? We believed what God said about Jesus. We were baptized in water for the reasons that God said, please, folks, please, 4 years, I'll see you in 4 years. For no reason on this earth, not impatience, which we sometimes get. Not mob mentality, which we sometimes get. For no reason on earth should you ever depart from the revealed New Testament plan for worship, for work, and for faith. It's tempting. Whataburger churches. We'll make it how you want it. People love it. Golden calf here, golden calf there, but I'm just trying to get to heaven, folks. Don't step off the pathway for idolatry. There were four things that got to them. And that was the first, and I think they learned a lot from that. You know, that was really early on in the process. And I think they learned that, you know what, we're going to have to do this only God's way. His pattern matters. And so maybe they kind of got back into good graces with the Lord. But go back to 1 Corinthians 10. Then something else pops up. Maybe you've heard of this. Maybe you've heard of people who have been raised up out of that water with the great hope of heaven before them, singing beautiful songs of victory, but they just don't get from there to heaven because of this second thing. I'm talking about verse 8 in 1 Corinthians 10. Nor let us act immorally, as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in one day. Immorality is dangerous. Immorality and sexual immorality and promiscuity and adultery and fornication and pornography are very, very scary, frightening, family-destroying, church-crumbling, deadly things. People do them anyway. Why do people do that? I'll tell you why I think people do it anyway. Because once you've been on that mountaintop and you see heaven there and it's where you're going and you know that God has laid out a path of moral purity, and if you step off a little bit to this side for just a little while, you can just step right back on. That's why people are immoral who know the truth. Let me just tell you something. Somewhere along the way, George Mallory or Andrew Irving took one step off of the pathway that was secure, and they never lived to tell the story. And I'll tell you this about immorality. While there are people who have lost their focus on heaven and their victory song, and they've gotten into adultery or pornography, and they found their way out of it, and if you're in it now, you can find your way out of it and get right back to God and right back on that path. The grace of God is amazing. There are plenty of people whose bodies have never been found. One of the first family funerals I ever attended, I was a teenager. My mom's brother, Uncle Jody. Uncle Jody committed adultery on his wife, my aunt, with some girl who was also married. And one night he decided to go to her house and her husband's house and get her and go. And her husband shot him in the stomach. And we buried Uncle Jody. He was raised to know the truth, raised in a church just like this one. Baptized, just like you. He stepped off the path and he never had a chance to get back. Folks, that's the story. Look here, you have a quote. If you're reading in verse 8, you'll notice, well, here I guess it's more of a reference, not an exact quote to the Old Testament, but you may have some marginal note that'll tell you that if you head back to Numbers 25, you'll find exactly what you're looking for. He is referencing the event of the Israelites in Numbers chapter 25. Let's read just a couple of verses. Will help us, three or four at the most. Numbers chapter 25, verses 1 and 2. While Israel remained at Shittim, the people began to play the harlot with the daughters of Moab, for they invited the people to the sacrifice of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel joined themselves to them, and the Lord was angry. Now look down a little bit further with me in verse 6. Now behold, one of the sons of Israel came and brought in to his relatives a Midianite woman. In the sight of Moses and in the sight of all the congregation of the sons of Israel, while they were weeping at the doorway of the tent of meeting. When Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saw it, he arose from the midst of the congregation and took a spear in his hand. And he went after the man of Israel into the tent and pierced both of them through, the man of Israel and the woman, through the body. They were probably together at the time. So the plague on the sons of Israel was checked. Those who died by the plague were 24,000. So 23,000 people, 23,000 people of God died in one day. And before it was all said and done, according to Numbers, 24,000 people. Look, I'm not going to spend the whole sermon, or any sermon this week, talking to you about the sin of lust, pornography, fornication, and adultery. Our angle this week is an eyes up, eyes forward angle. We're just trying to get to heaven. I want to go home. I'm going home. Let's get that want to go out of here. I'm going home. This is all going somewhere, and immorality is a tool of the devil to get me to step off that pathway where he has claimed many, many lives. Not me, not you. Let's go home. Go back with me to 1 Corinthians 10. Many died in that story. You just saw that in the text. But there were some who made it. They sort of pressed on forward and learned their lesson, and that's usually the case with things like idolatry. Some are restored back to the truth and immorality. Some avoid that sin. But when we get to our text and we get back to verse 9, I told you there are four things listed there, and here's the third one. Nor, he said, let me tell you another thing that cost them their journey's end, nor let us try the Lord. I'm reading from the New American Standard. Nor let us try the Lord, as some of them did and were destroyed by the serpents. Now, before I try to explain what he's talking about there, I think it would be better to just go look at the story. If you want to know what he means by trying the Lord, you already know this story about the serpents biting them and the standard that was raised. Let's just go take a quick look. So that takes us back to Numbers chapter 21. And in Numbers 21, we're going to see what led them astray. And again, I hope your attitude towards this is, I don't want to do this. I was baptized for a reason, and if trying the Lord can cost me my journey, I don't want to do that. Let's see if we can figure out what's happening. I'm back in Numbers chapter 21, and I'll begin in about verse 3. The Lord heard the voice of Israel and delivered up the Canaanites. Then they utterly destroyed them and their cities. Thus the name of the place was called Hormah. Now that's not actually a part of our story, but I'll tell you why I read it. It was good. The people cried out to God. God said, there's your cities. Look, I'm your God. I'm here. You didn't come up out of that water so you could somehow blindly find your way home. Maybe I'm going to lead you home. I'll get you there. I'll take care of your adversaries. I will take care of you. Right on the heels of that, you get verse 4. Then they set out from Mount Or by way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom, and the people became impatient because of the journey. The people spoke against God. I want you to think about this language. It's kind of frightening. They spoke against God and Moses. Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food and no water, and we loathe this miserable food. Can you believe they said that? They have forgotten the unbelievable things that God had done for them. They left a terribly oppressive situation for hundreds of years. And now the first time the journey gets hard, they are riddled with this very little scary word called doubt. You know what? We're kind of having our doubts. Maybe this whole follow God and walk towards some land, maybe it's not really worth all the time we're putting into it. I feel pretty hungry. My stomach growled once today. I'm feeling pretty left out by God. Maybe, just maybe, we've made a mistake here. We shouldn't be doing this. Maybe we should just go back to Egypt. They'll take care of us. Are you kidding me? That's what That's what trial does when our faith is weak. You know, it makes us doubt. Maybe I shouldn't be walking in the name of Jesus. Maybe this Christian life isn't the right way. Maybe I should go back and we put on those rose-colored glasses and we look back at that old life and think, man, I remember a lot of great things about that life. And they want to go back. So the Lord says, you know what? You can go back. But I'm going to send you back exactly like I found you, dying. In verse 6, the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people so that many of the people of Israel died. They didn't even get a choice. They just died. So the people came to Moses and said, we have sinned because we have spoken against the Lord and you. Intercede with the Lord that he may remove the serpents from us. And Moses interceded for the people. Then the Lord said to Moses, make a fiery serpent, set it on a standard, and it shall come about that everyone who is bitten, when he looks at it, he will live. One more verse. Moses made a bronze serpent, set it on a standard. It came about, if a serpent bit any man, when he looked to the bronze serpent, he lived. Now that is all the detail I can fill in for you as to how this unfolded, but I have a theory. My theory is the camp of Israel was right here. And they're saying, I don't know if we should be on this journey. I've been thinking about just giving up. And God said, okay, well, you were dying when I found you, and Egyptians were killing you guys just about every day, so let me just throw some serpents in there. That's where you were. You're poisoned again. Now, if you want to go back to Egypt, it's over there. Go. Maybe you'll make it. Maybe when you get there, they'll open the gates and welcome you in and give you some serum to save you from your snake bite, and you'll live. If Egypt's over there, I've got a really strong feeling that God put the bronze serpent over on this side. You're dying. Go for it. Or turn your back on the old life and stop thinking about it and stop doubting that we made the right decision and you go this way. That relates directly to the Christian life. When God found us, we were snake bit, folks. The venom of sin had filled every vein in the room. The devil had his way with us, and some of us died in it without ever having a chance to be free. Some of us were cleansed, cleaned, and freed by God. Mountaintop experience. And when we say, God, I doubt you. I don't really know if this is the right thing anymore. I'm not even sure if I really believe in God anymore. And I've got all these questions about the Bible. God says, the venom of sin is back in you. And in John chapter 3, Jesus is that standard. Jesus is the one that's been lifted up. You know the comparison in John 3 between this story and Jesus. You got two choices. They're yours. You can keep looking to Jesus and learning and loving and serving and believing in him, and I will keep you clean. Or you can try to head back. See what happens. All I can tell you is, I have seen in my short years of preaching, I have seen people who have left the Lord. Look at our list. I have seen people who have been baptized into Christ. We've celebrated that as a family. And I've seen them get involved in false religion, shortcuts, easy ways, and walk away. Not many, thankfully, not many, but some. And I have seen people who got involved in immorality, and you have too. Who got involved in adultery and destroyed their families or married someone else or got into difficult situations and they left the Lord and they never came back. Not a whole lot. I mean, some, too many. Any more than none is too many. But this is scary. Because this can grow in us for a really long time. I don't know. I don't know if church is right for me. I don't know if this Christian walk thing is really the right thing. And then, before we know it, we start seeing the life of sin for what it isn't, what it ain't, what it wasn't. All I can tell you tonight without preaching on it all night is if there is any doubt in your heart anywhere, if it's that big, address it. Get that doubt out of there. If you've got questions about the authenticity of your scriptures, then start reading material on the authenticity of the scriptures. If you've got any doubt that Jesus was a man and a miracle worker and the tomb was empty and the evidence is overwhelming, then read about that and harmonize the Gospels and study. Do not let doubt strip you of what God has put in your hand as a free gift of Jesus. to return to a life that, remember, I'm not going to hit the mic again, but remember, you left it for a reason. Don't go back. A lot of them did. But I'm going to tell you about me. I'm not being boastful here. I'm about the humblest guy on this you'd imagine, but I've got to start somewhere, and I'm starting with this. I'm going home. I'm going home with God. And He's the one that's going to get me there. Let me show you one more thing. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. We're going home. We're going to watch out for these things. Now, these are pretty big deals. The first three that are listed here. Normally when you build a four-point sermon or you're reading through a series of ideas in Scripture, that fourth one is sort of the big momentous one. You know, the crescendo, the final act. So I would imagine that whatever this fourth thing is we need to be careful of is going to be this just amazingly potent thing. But when you get to the verse, here's what you find. He started with idolatry, verse 7, immorality, verse 8. Doubting God, verse 9. And then he says, nor grumble, as some of them did, and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now that's a little anticlimactic, right? I mean, grumbling? Like complaining? I mean, I can understand immorality. But just, well, here's the word I chose. Just being generally discontented with stuff? Is that really that big a deal? I'm going to make this argument to you for the next 2 minutes. I think that the fourth thing is probably more of a danger to God's people than the other three combined. Because with this fourth one, we keep coming to church. We keep going to worship. We keep around. You know, during their time of doubt, they were thinking about just leaving. But most of the time, they weren't leaving. It's not like God, we're going to go back to Egypt. No, they were just saying, we're going to stay. This is our church. That's our God. You're our Moses. That's our journey. But man, let me list about 10 things I don't like that's going on around me right now. The dangerous thing about complaining and being discontent is people can just do it for years and years and years and years and just slowly drain the morale of life-giving waters out of the pool. And then before you know it, there's just no heart left in churches, in families, and in people. I could show you so many examples of them grumbling. I went through one time with a green pencil and just marked Israel's journey, grumble, complain, grumble, complain. So I think I'll just ask it to you this way. I told you about their mountaintop experience, right? You got that in the background here? How they came through that water and they were nourished by God, and they stood upon the rock that was Jesus, and their future was set. And I told you what chapter that was in. Do you remember what chapter I told you that happened in when they sang the song of Moses? Exodus chapter 15. All right, so I'm going to ask you a trivia question. Ready? Exodus chapter 15 is when they sang the beautiful, beautiful song of Moses. How many chapters later was the first time they complained? I'll give you a minute, but go back there to Exodus 15. The answer, I saw somebody out there raise up one finger. I think, depending on how you count, Eric, the answer is like zero. We didn't even get out of Exodus 15. We're still humming the tune of the song of victory. We're still basically standing on the top of Mount Everest, breathing in air that no man has ever breathed before. We haven't even really started walking back down yet to get to our great abode of peace light ahead of us, and we're already talking about the things we don't like. I'm still in Exodus 15. And I've moved forward to verse 24. So the people grumbled at Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" Chapter 16, verse 2, Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron. Chapter 16, verse 7, verse 8, verse 9, verse 12. And I could go on and on and on and on, almost every page. God was really patient, unbelievably patient. But there just came points in time where God looked down at His church. That's what they were, His church, His assembly, and said, "I cannot stand this anymore." Remember when he put the birds around the camp in Numbers? And they're, oh, we're hungry, and the man is great, but I mean, come on, I can only eat so much of that. And God said, I'll tell you what, I'll put birds all around the camp. I mean, I take care of you. I'm here to take care of you. Mountaintop home. I'm going to be there the whole way. Tell you what, go outside the camp and eat the birds. I'll bring them in. And there's all this preacher debate on whether they were just flying really low or they were dead and piled up. I don't know if they were dead and piled up. I think they were flying low and they were catching them with their bare hands. I have no idea. But God put it outside the camp. But he said, look, remember, eat this day, eat this day, eat this day. But on this day, grab two and don't eat. Remember what they did? They went out there and they doubled up on it. You see, that's what complainers are doing. They're just saying, I want stuff I'm not getting. It's like 2 degrees too cold in here. I want this. And so it's just grab like that. And we don't think about the team and where we're going and what we're about and our victory in heaven and home. We're just thinking about this right here. And we don't know how to reach out and satisfy this a little. So we added both. And you remember what happened? They died by choking on the bird while it was still in their mouth. God called it graves of greediness. I don't know what to tell you. I'm going home. We ought to be the most thankful, tolerant, patient, loving people that this world has ever known or experienced. But I think churches are shrinking because I don't think people want to go to places where people complain about everybody else. I can do that at home. I was raised in that. I want a place where people love who they are. They love who they're with. They love what they did, mountaintop, and they love where they're going. And we're going to get there together, and we're not going to let any little petty thing get in the way. Can I just tell you that people in the world are looking for that? They really want that. And that's what God's people could be. I think that's a pretty dangerous one, and I am not going to be burdened by discontentment. Let me show you one last thing. Positive ending, 1 Corinthians. In 1 Corinthians 10, he lays out all four of these, and I think about them a lot because I just don't want to step off that pathway. And he ends it in verse 11, 12, and 13 with some ideas here. Well, verse 11 is about example. We're going to look at verse 12, 13, and 14, and then we're done for the night, we're done for the week, and we're 2 minutes early. All right. Three things I'm going to leave you with. Verse 12. Are you in 1 Corinthians 10? You will not be asked to leave there again. You're in your final spot here. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed that he does not fall. That's a big one. What does that mean? That means that I have to be careful lest I read these stories and I look at Israel and say, oh, I cannot believe they behave like that. But I know people at church who behave like that. Let me just tell you. And I'm willing to say, this can happen to me. I am subject to all of the same errors and pathway as anybody else. And as soon as I think that it's not going to happen to me or it's not going to happen to this church, then we're just inviting it to happen to ourselves and to this church. One thing we're going to be moving forward is very, very humble. I preached on Sunday about how there's one Lord and two criminals and we're way down here and he's way up there. And we see the difference between a Lord and a criminal. And when you notice that difference, it just makes you want to grovel for his love and pursue him and just hopes that he would even say a word of peace to you, which he will. When I start thinking that, you know, I got this. Other people don't. I'm inviting failure. So number one, let's just be really, really humble about ourselves. Number two, no temptation, verse 13, has overtaken you, but such as is common to man. And God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will provide the way of escape also, so that you will be able to endure it. Number two, believe that God can get you through. Be humble about you and believe that God can get you through. God is not leaving you on the mountaintop saying, good luck getting home. The Lord is with you always, even to the ends of the age. The Lord is near you. The Lord is working with you, for you, and around you. No matter what temptation you face, if you have issues of discontentment and anger and murmuring, God will provide you an escape from that sin. You do not have to live with it. If you are addicted to pornography or immorality, God, you're not going to like it because it's going to be public accountability. Nobody likes that. But God will provide you a way of escape so that you can get over it and move past it. If it's idolatry, God will provide you direction so that you don't replace Him with the truth. I believe in God. And I believe that He can give me the strength to get home. He is my shield and my protector. And then verse 14, therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. I believe that idolatry here is put forward, and I'm not big on my figure of speech idiom terms. It's a synecdoche metonymy or something. But I think it's put for all four things, basically. Flee, idolatry here is put for all of it. I mean, just flee that. And look, we can preach, and I hope that you've enjoyed the week. I hope that you've learned some things. I hope that you think, boy, those studies are really good for me. But look, no matter how much you believe in God tonight, and no matter how humble you are, we still got to walk out those doors in a minute and make real choices. Flee or pursue. Do or don't do. Say or don't say. It's not the preaching that does it. It's me saying, I'm going to not do that, and I'm going to do that because verse 13, I believe that God can lead me down the right pathway. And verse 12, I'm humble enough to know that I need to take responsibility for my decisions. Be humble. Trust God. Make the right choices. And you will make it home. You're going to heaven. Nobody will ever take that from you. If we learn from these people and we do what is right. Folks, I'll say this though. I've got to say, it's the last night. It's very important. Why are we talking about going home if you haven't been on top of the mountain yet? You need to breathe that air, folks. You need to feel that moment of relief, of accomplishing a life's mission of freedom and glory. You need to breathe it in. If you've been in slavery, oppressed by the work of the devil, you need to see the waters crashing on the devil as you come free to the other side for the very first time in your entire adult life. If you're not a Christian, you need to be baptized tonight. So you'll know what we're talking about. And then we'll all look home together. Look up Zion to the top where we really want to go. And we'll get there. If we can help you, assist you, that's what we're here to do. It's together we stand and sing.
A fountain filled with blood drawn from